This is Book Club Treats, a podcast for book clubbers who just can't seem to find the time to read. I'm your host, Lippy Turner-Rahman, and today we'll be talking about Once Upon a River by Diane Sederfield. On a very cold winter solstice night in 1887, the doors of the Swan Pub crash open to reveal a bloody, dripping monster holding a doll. Or is it a puppet? The monster is a man with a terrible head injury, and the doll an otherworldly dead little girl. Henry Dunt crashed his rowboat on the shores of the Thames, and the little body, with no shoes and wearing just a thin cotton shift, floated into his arms. The Thames River takes centre stage in Diane Sederfield's novel Once Upon a River. Just as the river and its tributaries meanders, changes flow and direction, and suddenly merge to become one, so does this tale of three missing girls. From our opening punch, we meander as different strands and backstories of the three girls' families are introduced, changing direction numerous times before rushing to a climax. It's a wonderful read. Once Upon a River is a magical realist tale. It's actually a fairy tale for grown-ups, with elements of Charles Dickens and Edgar Allan Poe. If you haven't read any Dickens, his tales always start out with a vast cast of characters from all different stations of life who seem to have nothing in common with each other. But by the end of the tale, Dickens has skillfully interwoven all their stories together to show past and present connections. Dickens really is the master of creating order out of disorder. If you ever haven't read any Charles Dickens, you really should. He is just a consummate storyteller. Sederfield charmingly and cleverly incorporates folklore and the art of storytelling in her tale. The book's atmosphere and its narrative style takes its cue from a really good storytelling session around a pub. The book is moody, atmospheric, magical, whimsical, tragic, and serious. Sprites, ghosts, and advice-giving pigs pepper this tale. At the heart of the book is the tale of the ferryman Quietly. One of the book's central characters, Rita Sunday, narrates a version of Quietly's tale to Henry Dunt on page 151. Many years ago, in the days when there were fewer bridges than there are today, the Quietlys lived on the banks of the river not very far from here. They were a family with one peculiarity. The men were all mute. That is why they were called Quietly, and no one remembers their real name. They built punts for a living, and for a reasonable price would ferry you across the river from their yard and come collect you again when you hailed them. The yard passed down from grandfather to father to son over many generations, along with the inability to speak. You might think being unable to speak would be a difficulty in the matters of romance, but the Quietlys were dependable, kindly men, and they were women who like a peaceful life. It so happened that in every generation, some woman was found who would be content to love without conversation and bear the next generation of punt builders. And all the little girls could speak, and none of the boys. At the time of this story, the Quietly of the day had a daughter. She was the apple of his eye and doted upon by her parents and grandparents alike. One day, she went missing. They looked everywhere for the child, alerted neighbours. Until night fell, the riverbank rang with the sound of her mother and other people calling her name. She was not to be found, not that day, nor the next. But after 3 days, her poor drowned body was recovered from a spot a little way downstream, and they buried her. Time passed. Through the rest of the winter and the spring and the summer and autumn, the girl's father continued building punts, as before, ferried people over the river when needed, and in the evening sat smoking by the fireside. But his muteness altered. The silence that had once been warm, good-humoured, and full of companionship grew dark and was filled with grey shadows. The year turned full circle and came to the anniversary of the day when the child disappeared. On that day, Quietly's wife returned home from the market to find a customer waiting. "Oh, if you need to cross the river, it's my husband you want. You'll find him in the yard," she told him. But the customer, whose face she now saw was pale, said, "I have already found him. He took me halfway across the river, and when we were at the deepest place, he handed me the pole and stepped out of the punt." Rita paused to take a sip. "And he haunts the river till this day?" Dunt asked. "The story isn't over yet. After 3 days, Quietly's wife was weeping by the fireside at midnight when there came a knock at the door. She could not think of a single person likely to call her on her at such a late hour. Could it be someone wishing to cross the river? She went to the door. Out of fear, she didn't open it, but only called, "It's too late. Wait till morning and my father-in-law will take you across." The answer came, "Mama, let me in. It's cold outside." With trembling hands, she unlocked the door and in the porch found her own little girl, the one she had buried a year to the day, alive and well. Behind the child was her husband, Quietly. She clutched the girl in her arms, wept to have her back, too overjoyed at first to wonder how such a thing had come to pass. Then she thought, "It cannot be." And she held the child at arm's length to stare at her. But it was unmistakably the very same daughter she had lost 12 months before. "Where did you come from?" she asked in wonderment. And the little girl answered, "From that place on the other side of the river. Daddy came to get me." The woman turned her eyes to her husband. Quietly stood a little way back from the child, not in the porch, but on the path. "Come in, dear," she said, and opened the door wide and gestured to the hearth, where the fire was lit and his pipe was still on the mantel. But Quietly did not step forward. She couldn't help but notice he was altered, though it was hard to say exactly how. Perhaps he was paler and thinner than he had been before, or perhaps it was his eyes that was a darker version of the colour they had been before. "Come in," she repeated, and Quietly shook his head. She understood then that he would never be able to come inside again. The good woman drew her daughter inside and closed the door. And since that day, any number of people on the river have met Quietly on the river. There was a price to be paid for the return of his daughter, and he paid it. For all of eternity, he must watch over the river, waiting for someone to get into difficulty. And then, if it is not their time, he sees them safely to the bank. And if it is their time, he sees them safely to the other place, the one he went in search of his child, and there they must remain. Back at the pub, Margot Ockwell, the owner of the pub, calls Rita Sunday, midwife and nurse, to come deal with Henry Dunt's monstrous injuries. The dead girl Margot lays in another room, since there's nothing Rita can do for her. Rita checks that the girl is dead. She is. But for some strange reason, Rita keeps standing over the girl, checking and rechecking. She's drawn to the girl, and she rechecks her vitals again. Page 35. The door opened as it had opened before. The drinkers blinked away their memory of the man and saw this. Rita. The dead girl was in her arms. Again, Was it time's error? Were they drunk? Had they lost their wits? Too much had happened and their brains were full. They waited for the world to right itself. The corpse opened its eyes. The girl's head swiveled. Her gaze sent a shock through the room so strong that every eye felt the ripple, every soul was rocked on its mooring. Time went unmeasured, and when the silence was at last broken, it was Rita who spoke. "I don't know," she said. It was an answer to the questions they were too stunned to ask. An answer to the questions she could scarcely form herself. "I did sort of think here, all right, are we headed into the realm of the undead, which usually really scares me?" But it didn't. As the news spreads about the once dead and now alive girl, three families rush to the pub to claim her. Remember what I said about the tale being Dickensian? Vast amounts of characters with seemingly nothing in common, we now see them at the pub. All these people are really from different walks of life, but their lives are already entangled. They just don't know it yet. The first to reach the pub is Robert Armstrong, a mixed-race prosperous farmer whose no-good son, Robin, married then deserted a woman for money. Robert and his wife, Bess, have just found out that they have an unknown daughter-in-law and a granddaughter, Alice, somewhere. Robert tracks his daughter-in-law down to a brothel, but he's too late. She's committed suicide and have apparently thrown Alice in the river. Robert thinks that the girl in the pub could be his granddaughter, but since he has no idea what Alice actually looks like, he dashes off to find Robin to positively identify the girl. Helena Vaughan dashes to the pub to positively identify the child as her daughter, Amelia. Amelia was kidnapped from her bed 2 years ago. Even though a ransom was paid, no trace of her was ever found. Helena knows without a doubt that the mute little girl is her Amelia, even though Amelia could speak. Her mother's heart just knows it's her. Helena grew up on the Thames and married wealthy Anthony Vaughan. Wildly happy and in love, their little girl completed them. 2-year-old Amelia was the apple of Helena and Anthony's eyes. Her disappearance destroys their marriage and saps all the happiness and will to live out of both of them, but especially Helena. Helena and Anthony become changed, not themselves, just sleepwalking through life, a little bit like quietly. Anthony Vaughan arrives at the pub after his wife has positively identified Amelia. He knows it's not her, but who can say no to Helena and her sorrow? Anthony's heart is sure it's not his darling child, but he's confused. He questions himself, but accepts the child as Amelia just for the sake of Helena and his marriage. Robin Armstrong gets to the pub after Anthony. He knows the child is not his. He faints to prepare a story to tell the audience. Robin spins a totally different version of his marriage. His wife abandoned him for a rich guy. The child could be Alice, but he's not sure. Robin makes no moves to take the child away from Helena, but asks to visit. Robin is playing a waiting game. He's planning on blackmailing the Vaughans. Rita Sunday knows Robin is lying, since his pulse was normal when he fainted, and that the child is not his. Lily White is the last person to claim the mute girl. Lily is a naive, confused, tormented, frightened housekeeper. She arrives at the pub, but hides and watches, convinced that the child is her dead sister Anne, a ghostly girl who blames Lily for her death and torments her. Lily is happy that Anne will live comfortably with the Vaughans and out of the way of her vicious stepbrother. The strange little girl has a hypnotic pull for everyone. The river, though, is the thing that draws the child. She's constantly looking at it, waiting for someone on the river. Who is the girl waiting for? How could she come back from the dead? And who is she? Is she Amelia, Alice, or Anne? Why doesn't she speak or recognize any of the people that claim her? Whoever she is, she goes home with Helena and Anthony Vaughan as Amelia. Let's meet the other important characters in this lovely tale, shall we? All the other characters live along the banks of the River Thames. The Swan Pub, where much of the major action and creation, fine-tuning and crafting of the most engrossing version of the tale takes place, is owned by Margaret Ockwell and her storyteller husband, Joe. Storytelling, lubricated by ale, is the lifeblood of the pub. Margot's 12 daughters are married, but her son Jonathan, who has Down syndrome, lives at home and is a storyteller just like his father, but the actual gift of storytelling escapes him. In the midst of this magical and otherworldly atmosphere, two characters stand as pillars of rationality and science: Rita Sunday and Henry Dunt. Rita was born in a convent, trained by the sisters to be first-class midwife and nurse. But delivering babies and seeing mothers die makes Rita scared to have children of her own. Rita and Henry fall in love, but she won't acknowledge it to Henry since she knows Henry really wants to have children. The silent girl draws her in, though. The day Rita stopped believing God is the day that she decided to leave the convent. She misses God, though, some days. Rita is determined to understand how the child could appear to be dead. She doesn't believe that the child was actually dead and just came back to life. With Henry's help, Rita runs various scientific experiments to understand the way that the heart can flatline to protect itself. The little girl's rescuer, Henry Dunt, is a photographer. The Thames is his speciality. His wife's death gets Henry in a funk. He getting bashed about on the river, saving the girl and meeting Rita is just the tonic he needed. Henry buys a houseboat and sets up his developing studio on it and goes up and down the Thames photographing it and Rita, but mostly Rita. He loves Rita desperately and wants to marry her. Robert Armstrong is an illegitimate interracial farmer, born from a liaison between an aristocrat and a slave servant girl. He is lucky in that his father was honourable enough to educate and take care of him. Robert's father buys him a farm. Robert talks to animals and his animals talk back to him. His most ardent bond is with his pigs, Maud and Mavis, but Robert is still grieving over the theft of Maud. Robert marries Bess, a neighbouring farmer's daughter, after she's raped by his farmhand. Robin may not be his biological son, but Robert claims him as his own, loves him as his own. Bess has an eye which she keeps covered with a patch that can see a person's true nature. Bess has seen her son's true nature and knows that he is just no good. There are spoilers ahead. Anthony knows from the start that the unknown girl is not Amelia, even though having her as Amelia returns Helena, his marriage, and happiness back to him. It's a happiness that's tinged with awful truth. Anthony knows that Amelia is dead. The night of the ransom exchange, it was raining hard, and Anthony dropped the money in the assigned place but tripped over a sack containing Amelia's body. Traumatized by shock and grief, he lets the Thames River take the little body away. He never tells Helena what happened, but as soon as he returns empty-handed, Helena knows her daughter is dead. Both parents know their daughter is dead, and both knows that each is aware of that fact, but neither acknowledges it. To acknowledge Amelia's death would destroy Helena's hope. These two parents, my Lord, it made me so, so sad. A 10-year-old Lily is tricked by her stepbrother into believing that she drowned her 4-year-old sister in a sack. Lily runs away in horror and shame. Unfortunately for her, her stepbrother tracks her down, kills the man Lily married, and has since been physically, verbally, and mentally terrorizing Lily. Her stepbrother uses Lily's dilapidated cottage as a front for his bootlegging business. The only one to really listen to her is the pig. So who connects all these disparate people's stories? It's shadowy, vile Victor Nash. Bootlegger, rapist, murderer and thief. Just your typical all-round evil bad guy. Wow. Victor Nash is Lily White's stepbrother, Bess Armstrong's rapist and Robin Armstrong's biological father. He stole Maud the pig, and Victor Nash is the kidnapper murderer of Emilia Vaughan. Really, this guy sure gets around. The seed really didn't fall far from the tree in Robin Armstrong's case. Robin mistakenly thinks he's the illegitimate son of the aristocrat instead of Robert. Basically, from that day forward, he looks down on Robert and just milks him in affection and money. Robin is shady, and then he gets in with a shadier crowd where he meets Victor Nash. Robin helps Nash steal Maud the pig, swindle people, and it's Robin who was the brains behind the scheme to kidnap Emilia Vaughan. Nash threw the sack containing Emilia, but Robin failed to catch it, and the sack hit the side of the boat. Poor, poor child. Robin doesn't know Nash is his father. He only knows that he fears and despises him and owes him a hell of a lot of money. The climax of Once Upon a River arrives on a winter solstice, exactly 1 year to the day the little girl was found. The weather turns, the river floods, and the little girl disappears. Everyone spreads out frantically looking for her. Robin arrives at Armstrong Farm for money, and under a tree with the rain lashing around and flood water rising, hears the truth of his birth from Vincent Nash and Robert Armstrong. Robert is heartbroken by his son's actions, but Nash is proud as a peacock. He's always known Robin was his. He envisions a father and son crime syndicate. Robin is horrified and knifes Victor to death. They fall into the river, and a heartbroken Robert sees quietly appear and take both Victor and Robin to the other side of the river. Robert implores quietly to return his son to him, but no dice. Quietly doesn't agree. Robert goes to the pub where Joe dies and Helena's son is born. On page 444, Christopher lets the pub know where the little girl is. Where, Jonathan? Where was she? In the punt that came for father. Oh, Jonathan. Despondently, she led him back to the winter room. Tell us just what you saw in the order from the start. Well, father died, and he was waiting for quietly, and quietly came, like mother said he would. He came right up to the window in his punt to take father to the other side of the river. And when I looked out, there she was, in the punt. I said, everybody's looking for you. And she said, tell them my father came to fetch me. And then they went away. He's very powerful in a punt, her father. I've never seen a punt go so fast. There was a lengthy pause. The child doesn't speak, Jonathan. Do you remember that? Don said kindly. She does now, Jonathan said. As they were going, I asked, don't go yet. And she said, I'll come back, Jonathan. Not for a long time, but I'll come back and I'll see you then. And then they went. Sitting quietly, Robert Armstrong knows that Jonathan speaks the truth, as he saw the little girl sitting on Quietly's boat when he rowed Victor Nash and Robin to the other side. The book wraps up with Rita and Dunt marrying and having a baby girl, Helena and Anthony and their new baby boy move to New Zealand to start over. Robert Armstrong's granddaughter Alice is found in a workhouse and reunited with her grandparents. What happened to the strange little girl? Well, she's seen on the punt with Quietly. Slowly over the years, she grows and takes over the punting responsibilities from Quietly until it's just her on the punt, helping people to shore when it's not their time and taking others to the other side when it is their time. Once Upon a River is written in a third person singular. The writing is lush and gorgeous, and there are passages that have a really dreamy quality to them. It really celebrates the magic of the art of oral storytelling. The story meanders a little bit in the middle, though, just like a river. I really liked this book. It was like reading a wonderful, frothy fairy tale. There were moments of suspense, horror, and then sweetness and light, a little bit like a Midsummer Night's Dream on the Thames, with a little bit of Frozen and Dickens thrown in. And just like any good fairy tale, the darkness was always lurking, and that made it a little bit edgy. Not a Stephen King kind of edge, but an edge nevertheless. I finished the book over a couple of nights, although I did do a marathon night reading from page 320 onwards. I really wanted to know who this little girl was. Boy, was I tired the next day. Initially, I thought it was Amelia, and then maybe Alice, but it became pretty apparent, or did to me, that she was neither of these girls. Interestingly, the little girl drifts through the story just like a ghost, and she's a vessel for many people's dreams and desires, and the catalyst that brought buried secrets to the surface. One small detail that really bothered me: if the little girl was Quietly's daughter, had she given up her life for his life later on in the story? Or was this entirely new daughter? It's okay. It's these strange conundrums that give myths their twists. Here are some potential book club questions. Once Upon a River is interesting as it highlights fatherhood and the bond between fathers and their children, Anthony and Amelia, Robert and Robin, and the Quietly and his daughter. Why do you think books explore the mother-child relationship more frequently than the father-child bond? What were the differences and similarities between each father-child bond in this book? And how does your relationship with your own father compare with your relationship with your own children, if you have any? The art of oral storytelling is highlighted in this book. Has this art fallen out of favour in our digital age? How do you think storytelling has changed in the last 20 years? And what's the difference between fake news and embellishing and editing and reworking the story as the punters of the pub do? What's the purpose does storytelling have in our society? And what are your favourite stories and why? Rita Sunday and Henry Dunn are the beacons of science and logic in this story. Is science incompatible with myth, magic and God? And what's your favourite fairy tale or folklore and why? I hope you read this book if you get a chance. It really was a very sweet and lovely book. Bye-bye.